Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists absolutely had it correct. And this is Tom Navolis, your host. Delighted to be back with you again this week. And we are going to take just a brief comment about the Roe decision. But what we're going to deal with more is that of all of the actions of the pro-choice, the pro-abortion, pro-murder, pro-destruction of a nation crowd, and that these actions that are going on now were actually predicted, if not devised in a certain mechanism all the way back in the early 1900s. And we're going to be discussing that from the historical perspective of a Mr. William Foster, as well as a comparison to Jan Kosak, and that which I've talked about a number of different times on the pressure from below and the pressure from above, and what we're seeing in that regard. But even more so from that perspective, focusing a bit more on the pressure from above. How does it get there? How did it get there here in these United States? Is it really there? And where along in the path of our early 20th century history did we allow that to come into play? So we're just kind of going to walk down those paths a little bit and try and bring to you that, which I mentioned before and which I started to write an article about, actually. So the article, not having the time to write like I actually would like to, the program is, in essence, the article. So with that, where I would like us to begin is kind of talking about none other than William Z. Foster being the protagonist, leading the early strategies that have brought us to almost a decade of riots in the streets. And when we really consider that, when we really take into not just the George Floyd issues, you know, going back into the Obama administration itself, knowing that those were communists that were coming into the administration, not just globalists. We look at this multi-tiered effect that is happening upon the citizens of these United States and the Constitution. The issue is not only do we have those that have been working for over 100 years to move the United States into a socialist and then a communist democratic country, but we have the global billionaires, the global overlords that just want power. They just want to run everything. And they really, quite frankly, they really do not care what form of dictatorial, high-pressure government is in place, as long as you cannot think for yourself, as long as you do not have the freedoms and liberties to make those types of choices that a thinking person would be able to have, but that you would just be their minions and those that they have been creating through the educational system, and even in employment. Now, in the course of this program, I do want to, and I'm not going to be cutting in and out here in the short 45 minutes that we have, but I have a link to a Tucker Carlson program that he did on the 28th, so on June 28th. Very well done, very well thought out. He brings into the mechanisms of business, corporations, as well as in government, the ideas that the Roe decision has subtly been working along for the decades that it's been in place, but now is going to be accelerated from these outside pressures, including all that is there with, you know, I guess now in modern times we call them the woke company, but those corporations, those companies that are led by the power-mongering globalists that are only looking at what they think is their bottom line. So they have, again, as I talked about last week, no moral continuity. So with that, the whole idea is that this is nothing new to which we are experiencing. Everything that we have going on actually in some respects takes it back to even a court case. So when I was going to talk about the impact of the courts in relationship to the destruction of the Constitution, which I did talk about somewhat last week, but more specifically looking at that and even the political parties, including, as we know, the Uniparty, that being the combination of the Democrat Party as well as the establishment Republican Party. I do always slip with that, you know, because the establishment does always repudiate everything that is sound, moral, and constitutionally, fundamentally correct. So let me talk to you about the court just for a few moments, because in one of his writings, Mr. Foster takes and comments about the court. Now, we'll get into who Mr. Foster is a little bit later. Maybe we'll start it in this segment, and definitely we're going to pick it up in the second segment and talk about several of his writings, as well as his primary writing that we're going to discuss for sure today, that is called The American Road to Socialism, that was written in 1952. And that how in this book and in the whole idea of the Communist Party of the United States, or CPUSA, Communist Party of the United States, they use democracy a lot. So when you hear on the mainstream media, when you hear coming out of these politicians that are associated to the Democrat Party, they keep talking about our democracy being destroyed. The fact of the matter is, when you take a constitutional sound stand as intended, or to that which fundamentally even Donald Trump was standing for, you're going to destroy their idea of democracy, because their idea of democracy, which they have been building for the last 120 years, is not the democracy that you think of from the Greeks or even the Romans. It is a dictatorial form of what? Of government. A dictatorial form of government. So let me go with this quote before I jump over to this court case. Is that one of the things, something, a key point that was written, and this is out of what Foster wrote, and he claims that Marx said this: thus, Karl Marx, three generations ago, and remember this was in 1952, before the advent of imperialism with its highly centralized, heavily armed, and bureaucratic state, said that, quote, if for example, the working class in England and the United States should win a majority in Parliament, in Congress. It could legally abolish those laws and institutions which obstruct its development. So that takes us to the idea of getting communists and socialists elected. And you sit there and you go, wait a minute, how could that happen? How could that happen? How could a communist get elected? Well, there was this court case actually in 1942, and this was all under the idea that that communists, and it was in this one particular individual, Schneiderman, who came into the United States in 1906 and alleged illegally produced or procured naturalization. The guy was an avowed communist from the beginning, and you can say that. You say, wait a minute. The communists didn't come in till, you know, the 1917 revolution. Remember, you can still, you know, get a prize if you can tell me when Karl Marx released the Communist Manifesto. So communism was in effect. It wasn't predominant, but it was in effect when Karl Marx released that manifesto. So when was it? So anyway, Schneiderman, Justice Department went after him because he came to America. He immigrated with his parents. He was an avowed communist all of his life. He joined the Workers' Party, which later became the Communist Party USA in 1924. In 27, he became a naturalized citizen. He never was charged with any crimes. He never did any unlawful behavior, but he started to rise up, and in 1932, he ran on the Communist Party ticket for the governor of Minnesota. The federal government then went on to try and denaturalize him, arguing that his citizenship was illegally procured because he was an avowed communist, and that he was attached to the principles of communism and not to the principles of a constitution of the United States, which is required, especially at that time, in the Naturalization Act of 1906. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they determined that he wasn't being violent or anything like that. And the fact was, is that there was insufficient evidence that he was against the Constitution of the United States, even though he was an avowed communist. Take that in. I'm pausing here so that you can really take that in. Now, we're going to get into it into the next section here, where it is very, very plain that communism and communists have always had the intentions of destroying constitutional America, these United States. They wanted to introduce socialism and introduce communism. Now, the interesting aspects of this court is that the Chief Justice was Harlan Stone, and Associate Justices were Owen Roberts, Hugo Black, Stanley Reed, Felix Frankfurter, William O. Douglas, Frank Murphy, Robert H. Jackson, and Wiley Rutledge. Half the court were socialist or leaned towards socialism and even potentially communism. Now, that is a study that I've talked about before. So the court and members of the court were sympathetic to communism and that ideology already in America. Well, Sam Adams was against utopianism And we'll talk about that definitely in the third segment when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are already in this second segment of Samuel Adams Returns, and those anti-federalists, boy, they were so predictive. And we talked about that in the court, and we talked about Yates last week and all of those various ideas. What I just mentioned and finished up with in the first segment was the makeup of the court that did the 1943 decision on Schneiderman versus the United States and what the Supreme Court decided. So just as to look at the majority opinion real quick as we move then on into who William Foster is or was, I should say, is that Justices Murray delivered the opinion, which was joined by Justice Black, Reed, and Douglas, and Rutledge on June 21st in 43. Disagreeing with the government's argument, the court reversed the lower court's ruling. Murphy reasoned that one could be attached to the Constitution principles without agreeing with each one of its provisions, citing the First Amendment as free expression protections and Article 5's constitutional amendment process. He wrote that the constitutional fathers, fresh from a revolution, did not forge political straitjacket for the generations to come. And as Justice Holmes said, surely it cannot show lack of attachment to the principles of the Constitution that one thinks it can be improved. Next, the justices rejected the Justice Department contention that Schneiderman's membership in the Communist Party meant that he supported overthrowing the government by force. Discussing the details in writing of various communist leaders, Murphy determined that the Communist Party did not unequivocally favor actual violence against the government. Finally, the court determined that, in light of the First Amendment, clear, unequivocal, and convincing proof was necessary to denaturalize a citizen. What we have here is, you know, continuation from that court case in particular. What we see is that the First Amendment being turned on its ears. The First Amendment was not to take and destroy the principles, but as the judge is saying here, is that it cannot show a lack of attachment to the principles of the Constitution that one thinks it can be improved. Now, when we look at what does it mean to improve something, and we get into the whole idea of what it means to do in a court version of all things, then we have a lot that we have to consider. And we're going to talk about how this was used by William Foster when he took and was writing his works on how America would turn into a socialist country as it is, right, becoming now and today. We're going to talk about William Z. Foster a little bit now, and that the thinking and strategy on how to take and use the Constitution against itself, on how to use the Constitution to take and turn us into a socialist, communist type of a government. As you heard, Marx's idea in taking and getting people elected, that's the strategy. That's the strategy. But what happened here with Foster was that he was born in 1887. He was from Massachusetts, ended up moving to New York, raised as a poor guy, but he took and he, you know, did the American dream in so many different ways. He actually became a good worker, a hard worker. He ended up taking and having a good job in the local rail business that was there. He was an air brakeman, all of that. I mean, just very, very interesting. A trolley car conductor. But ultimately, he took and he fell in with a William F. Titus, who was uncompromising in preaching, actually, a version of faith and revolutionary class struggles. And then he went on from there. In 1910, he joined the Industrial Workers of the World, which ultimately he was involved in a free speech campaign out in Spokane, Washington, ended up in jail there. He also, in 1911, he went to an international union conference in Budapest, where he was there and became part of the American Federation of Labor. And then from that point, he kept on going. He actually tried to get Samuel Gompers and challenge. He supported John Lewis versus Samuel Gompers for the presidency of the AFL. And that was very interesting. In 21, he was invited to Moscow to become part of what is called the Profintern. The Profintern was, in fact, the Communist International Trade Union Council. And he became the representative of that in America. So he became the international communist representative in America. And then he also, as things transitioned into parts of the American Communist Party, and he was a part of that. Now, there were different contentions in the American Communist Party. You had those that wanted just to be haywire social, you know, communists and revolutionaries and all of that. But again, Foster was focused on labor. And his thing was is that if they could take and get labor to move en masse in taking and pushing for all these social economic changes, that they could push socialism in through that, and then starting to develop what would be needed to get candidates elected into not just the unions, but then into local government as well as into the national government. So as we go through and we look at the history, and it's there from on the website at samueladamsreturns.net, the references are there for you to go in with this. Now, Foster stayed a strong supporter of Joseph Stalin, and he remained in the American Communist Party. He was actually the 1928 presidential candidate. So he ran for president of the United States under the American Communist Party. He was obviously badly beaten. He only received 48,000 and change votes. That was 0.1%. And it was interesting on all of that. But he became obviously very fundamental in the American Party and developing the strategies that we have seen come about. Now, I want to shift over and begin shifting over to his, what do we want to call it? His writing on that I mentioned earlier on how American road to socialism. The important thing that came about in all the various writings that he did was in defending the Communist Party in America, and when we had the un-American investigations in the 50s, when we saw the rise of communism back in the 20s, it became the idea that, well, wait a minute, they're, as we saw from that court case, they're just expressing their First Amendment right. You know, we're not seeing the radicals out there. We're not seeing the necessity of radicalization and violence and all of that. But there's several areas here that we need to cover and then dive in a little bit more so that you understand that what we are living in, especially with the Democrat regime, are those that are after the communist democracy. And that is where they have been pushing all of what they do administratively. So this was seen, ladies and gentlemen, but most people were not aware. And then these folks were very, very good at using the courts, using, as I have said in I don't know how many programs, they use the Constitution and even the Anti-Federalist Papers to destroy this nation. So anyway, here's a right out of the preamble of the Communist Party USA. Quote, "The Communist Party upholds the achievements of the American democracy and defends the United States Constitution and its Bill of Rights against its reactionary enemies who would destroy democracy and popular liberties. It seeks to safeguard the welfare of the people and the nation, recognizing that the working class, through its trade unions and by its independent political action, is the most consistent fighter for democracy, national freedom, and social progress." Wow, that sounds almost benign, doesn't it? Don't you think? I mean, they're there to defend American, you know, the achievements of American democracy, defend the Constitution and the Bill of Rights against reactionary enemies, those who really believe in foundational principles of the Constitution, not in American democracy type stuff, as well as, gosh, you know, wait a minute, you know, who wants to destroy the democracy? Yeah, well, we're a republic. We're working under federalism, popular liberties, abortion, gay rights. What is it? Same-sex mirage, as Doug Wilson likes to call it, as well as all of these transgenderism, popular liberties. Well, there's no morality. They don't talk about morality. They don't talk about what? One nation under God. They don't talk about the Declaration of Independence, do they? They don't ever refer to that. They refer to the Constitution, and knowing that if they take and they get the proper people elected, they can do what Marx suggests is to take and remove what? Abolish, it actually says, if I look at the quote more correctly, that if you take and you get those elected and you can win the majority, and I'm taking parliament in Congress, it could legally abolish those laws and institutions which obstruct its development. That meaning the development of communism and socialism. Throughout this document that Foster wrote, The American Road to Socialism, democracy is used over and over. The democratic forces in our country raises democracy quantitatively. So here's the goals and objectives, and I'm going to start with it here. We'll finish it off in the third segment, is that the road to socialism is a peaceful transition to socialism in the United States. It takes four elementary considerations. First, the fight of the working class for its immediate demands is the very substance of democracy. It strengthens basically the democratic forces in our country, and by the eventual establishment of socialism, it raises democracy quantitatively to a new high level. Now, I don't know if you know, but some of what's going on in the different work stoppages, as well as what's happening with the airlines, is because the young pilots, the young people, the college graduates are making demands on businesses for what? Their rights as workers. They're pushing their idea of democracy. They're pushing this first element very strongly in the American workforce. People don't know that unless you know people inside the industry. And then we're going to talk about the second one. In the working class, led by Communist Party, harmonizes its methods. Well, that's not what Sam Adams was dealing with on that idea of universalism and that. But come on back in the next segment as we really get into what liberty really is in a constitutional America, and more on Foster. Welcome back to this third segment of Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists got it right. And I do want to just ask you that if you do find anything worthwhile in this programming, that you would go to samueladamsreturns.net and look at the references. But also, please, if you will, take and find somewhere in the crazy economy that we're in, that I know most patriots are already giving everything that they can. But if you can and you will, please donate something to this program, because it would be helpful to keep us going forward in what we do. So with that, we're getting back into this second idea of what Foster was talking about for the working class, led by the Communist Party. So now we have, and I talked to you years ago about how in 2010, the Communist Party USA claimed victory in now being the core, the root, the essence of the Democrat Party. Well, in 2010, a lot of people didn't believe that, but now we can see that. So what he talks about here is that it harmonizes its methods with its end by fighting for both its immediate and ultimate objectives. This was written in 1952, okay? With the most peaceful and democratic means possible. Third, the workers and their allies, constituting the vast majority of the people and possessing immense organizations, now have potential power to curb, restrain, and make ineffective whatever violence the capitalists may undertake in their attempt to balk the will of the people and to prevent the establishment of socialism. Wow. The violence is not on the side of the capitalists, that's for sure. Fourth, in recent years, on the international scale, there has been an enormous growth of power in the camp of democracy and socialism. Well, that's true on that global basis. All of the different nations out there go on democracy. They don't understand what a constitutional republic is. So the real issue in this, because we don't have a lot of time to deal with it, but I highly recommend that you go to the website at samueladamsreturns.net, where I do have this as a PDF with its source back to the revolutionarydemocracy.org and the archives in there, is that when Foster was looking at these arguments and what was happening on the especially in the 40s and the 50s, with communism being attacked, he wrote a book that is called In Defense of the Communist Party and the Indicted Leaders. And in that, he was making the claims that it wasn't communism that was on trial at the time with the different 11 defendants that were being prosecuted, but it was actually American democracy, which was up before the bar to take and determine what rights people would have. And the rights that they were looking at was to utilize the mechanisms of taking and controlling the political system. Now, what he also argued and was refuting from the government indictments was the idea that there was no conspiracy, in that he says here that the party holds a view that socialism in the United States, although inevitable in the future, is not now on the immediate political agenda. Therefore, the party has never and does not now venture to predict the precise time, forms, and methods of the eventual establishment of socialism in this country. Those who state that the CPUSA has a blueprint of some kind or is organizing a conspiratorial plot for achieving socialism are deliberate liars and perjurers. any consideration that the party therefore gives to his whole question at the present time to refute the government's indictment leveled against it can only be on the basis of an estimate of eventual working out of general communist principles in this country in the light of world experience and American political conditions. So what he was saying here, and he writes very clearly that Congress, you know what, you're taking in an investigating Justice Department, you're indicting, there's no plans, there's no timetable, there's no blueprint for a route to socialism. No, the American people, you know, the working class, they're going to come to their own conclusions on this. And what he was saying here, and he quoted Lenin, is that all nations will come to socialism. This is inevitable, but they will come to it in not quite the same manner. Each will contribute original features to this or that form of democracy, to this or that variant of the proletariat dictatorship, to this or that tempo of socialist transformation of the various aspects of social life. What we have in so many different ways is that the stratagem was there, the strategies to do it, but what they maintained was a flexibility. What they maintained even today is all of the various mechanisms by which they're able to, as you can hear in the Tucker Carlson video that I have there for you, is to take and, you know, point whatever they're doing, point the finger at you and transfer the blame. Now, this is good psychobabble, and I brought up about all the mental health stuff, and trust me to say that in here, mental health is well used, and the mechanisms of how to manipulate the mind are well instituted in methodologies that the communist socialists have used for 100 years. It's nothing new. So it's a tempo. It's how they want to come about with their forms of democracy. And it's all about the application of people's democracy. And he keeps using this people's democracy. But he also says that only Marxist-Leninism can lead the nation to socialism. And when you do the study of Marxist-Leninism, we all know that that is a iron-handed dictatorship. We see it everywhere across the world. I mean, look at China. Most recently, there's news articles out there that China has determined that they will be in lockdowns for the next 5 years. Really? How do you do that? What science are you following? What are the things that, you know, are allowing them to determine that? Well, they just determine it from the top. And if you think that elections are not manipulated, well, they are. And that's the whole idea. And it comes under this is that the general principles and perspective that the Communist Party has long proposed, the regular election under the United States Constitution of a broad coalition government, an American variant of the People's Front made up of representatives of the political and economic organizations of the workers, of those that can be duped. And he's talking about the Negro people that have been duped. Small farmers, which now we have the corporate farmers, are the ones instead of the small farmers. Intellectuals, that was real key. And intellectuals being those in the universities, absolutely key. And other democratic strata, who constitute the great bulk of the American people. In the 1948 election campaign, the Communist Party, through its General Secretary Eugene Dennis, stated this political policy as follows: for a people's government that will advance the cause of peace, security, and democracy, for an anti-imperialist, anti-monopoly government. What is projected is this slogan, it should be made clear, is a political objective that reflects the United Front program, which is bringing into broad coalition all democratic and anti-imperialist forces, including the third party movement. Interesting. Very interesting. So a lot of times I hear from a lot of my friends, well, Tom, why is it that the opposition, why is it that they all stick together? You even heard President Trump go, why is it that the Democrats can stick together? Why is it that they can vote in these blocks? Why is it? Well, there's your answer. The answer was constructed back in the 40s. That was talking about back in 1948. But the Communist Party, what they did in their campaign and their campaign slogan, they are united. Their intent has been, and although they have no blueprint, although they have no plan, although they are not a conspiracy, they stick together. They do that for what? Their short-term and long-term purposes, and they do what? They do long propose the regular election process, work inside the regular election process under the United States Constitution of a broad coalition of government. And then when you get the majority, like they have both House, Senate, and presidency right now, then you start slamming stuff through. And then not only that, if you take and you have 50 to 100 years of bureaucrats that keep coming in and building up those bureaucracies and increasing bureaucracies that are outside the limited powers of the federal government. And then on top of that, do what de Tocqueville said, is that Congress will remain in the ideas of liberty until they understand that they can bribe the people with their own money. And when we are bribed at the state level, now as we're seeing with this new gun legislation, as with every other thing that's out there, oh yeah, schools, you're not going to get any more money for food unless you train all the children on what it means about the trans lifestyle. Well played. Well done. Chipping away. So in these last 2 minutes, what's the plan, Tom? What does it mean to take and come together for those that are in the liberty movement? Quite frankly, I have a hard time with people in the liberty movement coming together. They operate on their egos more than those short-term and long-term goals. In fact, they have a lot of short-term goals, but no long-term goals. Kathy always says we're really in a mess. Well, we are. Quite frankly, we're in a big mess. And it is only by taking and extracting your children. So here's the basic answer. Cut the funding to all public schools, period. Unfortunately, in cases like Ohio, cutting it for universities is extremely difficult because they're in the Ohio Constitution that you have to fund them. But at the local level, stop funding. Stop all and every single levy as it comes forward. Don't vote for them anymore. Pull your kids out of school. Get your children, if you're a grandparent, to pull your grandchildren out of school. As I always say, too, the last few seconds here, get your churches to understand foundational principles and truth. Understand what it means from a biblical worldview. Get that centered. Get that functional within the churches. They need reformation because revival does not come without reformation and good, solid biblical preaching. So those are the core elements right there. You want to get the liberty that Sam Adams promoted, if you want to be part of that brush fire that ignites the mind to liberty, that's where you have to start. Come on back when Samuel Adams returns next week.